What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today we are continuing our series on revelation and work. So we intro'd this revelation thing, give a quick sort of introduction of which is needed a much more healthy introduction to the book of Revelation. But we talked about some things. We talked about the throne room scene in chapters 4 and 5 with the throne of God and the Lamb of God who is at that throne. And then last time we were here, we talked about Revelation 12 and 13 with the woman and the dragon and just the protection of God that God has for his church. And so today we're getting further into the book, actually almost towards the end of the book of Revelation in chapters 17 and 18, and talking about the harlot of Babylon. So when we were talking about chapter 12, we were not only introduced to the dragon, who is this embodiment of Satan, but we are also introduced to the two beasts, the beast from the sea and the beast from the earth. And these two beasts go about sort of carrying out the devil's plans, carrying out the devil's desires on the earth. Manifesting these the way of the world, really Satan's way on the world. And in chapter 17, we're introduced to a fourth character, which is the harlot of Babylon, who's actually sitting on one of the beasts. And so what we have is we have the introduction of these four characters in order in Revelation, earlier in Revelation. We have the dragon, the two beasts, and then the harlot. And what we're going to see from really chapter 18 to chapter 20 is the destruction of those four beings, but in a backwards order. First, the harlot is destroyed, and then the two beasts, and then finally the dragon, who is cast into the, you know, eternal pit of the fire, and all of that stuff. All those stuff you've sort of heard about Revelation before. So what's really interesting is in chapter 17 and 18, you have these kind of like, one is the introduction to the harlot of Babylon, and the next is the destruction of the harlot of Babylon. And I think that the harlot and what she represents really has a lot to tell us about ourselves, about the things that we might be prone to falling into, and some of these issues that we can get into. It's interesting just even noting off the top that last week we talked about the woman who's embodying the church, right? Who's being protected by God. This time we have a woman again, a solitary female character, but she's the embodiment of all that's against the church. And actually it says in 17 that we'll get to about how she has a chalice with the blood of the saints, which is like showing her going after the church, her persecution of the church, trying to take down the church. So when we're introduced to the harlot of Babylon in chapter 17, we see her sitting on this beast, and she was covered with blasphemous names. The beast was covered with blasphemous names and had 7 heads, 10 horns. It's very, very, very visual. Like you just kind of get this sick feeling when you hear about this woman and the beast and all that's going on here. And in verse 4 in chapter 17, it says, "The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries." And so what's interesting here is that this woman, this harlot, is very alluring. Right? She's dressed in purple and scarlet, which would have been these sort of royal colors back then. She's encrusted, you know, has all these diamonds and jewels, and she's very pretty, right? Someone you would be sort of allured to, someone you would kind of want to be with because of their beauty. And the interesting part about all this is it's sort of juxtaposed with this, like this beast, and she's together with the beast and she's alluring. And it's like this sickly sweet feeling, you know, or like this beauty that has an undertow of like, evil. Like you will be captured by the good side of these things, by the good looking, like all that glitters is not gold sort of scenario, right? That like you get drawn in by the beauty, but then taken in to the darkness with the harlot of Babylon. And that's what ends up happening. All these rulers and kings and, you know, all these people in high positions end up having adultery with her and giving in to her ways. And when she's destroyed, that's what we come to in chapter 18. Once the harlot and her ways are destroyed in chapter 18, the people who had gone after her, who had chased her, then pronounce woes. Like they're just sad about the woman, the harlot, going away. And I have a hard time really interpreting this passage any other way than sort of with the harlot being this economic system, this the economic piece of all this stuff that's sort of alluring people. And so I want to get into chapter 18. I'm going to read quite a bit of it. But I want to remember that we're not going to get lost in the weeds here. That's something I'm really trying to avoid. There's all sorts of amazing imagery in these books. There's all sorts of things we could delve into all the details. But I'd like to stay sort of out of the details and look at the big picture of what's really going on here. And I think reading this text will really help you see. So what I want you to think about as I read this text is I want you to think about why these people are giving woes over her. Why are they sad that the harlot is now gone? And then once we sort of have established that, then we can go back and we see what these things teach us about ourselves, about today, about what John is really trying to say is going on a little bit behind the scenes. So I'm going to start in verse 9 here in chapter 18. It says, "When the kings of the earth who had committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they will weep and mourn over her. Terrified at her torment, they will stand far off and cry, 'Woe, woe to you, great city, you mighty city of Babylon. In 1 hour, your doom has come.' The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, and scarlet cloth. Every sort of citron wood and articles of every kind made of ivory, costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble. Cargoes of cinnamon and spice, of incense, myrrh, and frankincense, of wine and olive oil, of fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and carriages, and human beings sold as slaves. They will see say the fruit you longed for is gone from you. All your luxury and splendor have vanished, never to be recovered. The merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. They will weep and mourn and cry out, 'Woe, woe to you, great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, in glittering gold with precious stones and pearls. In 1 hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. Every sea captain and all who travel by ship, the sailors and all who earn their living from the sea will stand far off. When they see the smoke of her burning, they will exclaim, 'Was there ever a city like this great city?' They will throw dust on their heads and they will, with weeping and mourning, cry out, 'Woe, woe to you, great city, where all who had ships on the sea became rich through their wealth. In 1 hour, she has been brought to ruin. Rejoice over her, you heavens. Rejoice, you people of God. Rejoice, the apostles and prophets, for God has judged her and the judgment she imposed on you.'" And so I think, like looking at these woes, it's very clear what's going on here. I don't think there's a lot of need to like really bicker about the like overall like big interpretation, which is that these woes come from three categories: kings, merchants, and sea captains. And that these three categories all are proclaiming woe over this great city of Babylon, this destruction of this harlot based on economics. What they're saying is these great things that you did for us are now gone. We have nothing to sell anymore because the harlot has been defeated. It's really interesting just how John, you heard earlier in verses 11 through 13, really like digs in like with what exactly they are missing, where they had done cargoes of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, right? Just listing all of these things that the merchants had once sold and that was really thriving because of their really adultery with the harlot. Pretty sobering at the end, where the last one is human being sold as slaves. I always feel like when I read a book like Revelation or something from the Bible, like very few things really ever change. In a lot of ways, these two chapters are really should sober us to the realities of how we live. I mean, the kings, the merchants, and the sea captains all gave themselves over. They all committed adultery with this great city in order to gain monetary value, in order to like up their own riches. They gave themselves over. And I think as we are in this world of work and in this world of you know, business, of consumption, that these should have something to speak to us, that these chapters should really sober us up to the ways in which not only we consume, but in the ways that we work and the kind of jobs that we do and how we use our resources for this world. And so I want to talk a little bit just about sort of the economic systems behind some of these things. And I'm not an economist. I have no expertise in these things. So I'm not critiquing one specific economic system over and against another. I have no business doing that. I have no business doing that. I should not be doing that. But what I can do is talk about the ways in which we all fit into our economic systems and the ways we all sell out to our economic systems a lot of times in order to gain some sort of wealth. So when I was in middle school, my mom and stepdad decided to kind of give their jobs up. They had jobs at the city and start a business based on this new product that they had developed. They were always developing new things. They're very entrepreneurial. And they quit their jobs to start this business. And part of this business was this invention that they had come up with that just, it's a tool that helps like run wires in ceilings. And so they started marketing this product and actually got a bigger company to kind of buy it and distribute it for them. But being ingenuitive people, they decided that the manufacturing they wanted to keep in America. So for most of my middle school and high school years, I spent, you know, a few days to a week or more a month sitting in front of an injection molding machine, assembling plastic parts as they came out of this machine. It was just kind of what our family did. Most of my friends had participated in the project at some point. You know, we did thousands of these guns a month, and we literally took these we took this product from raw plastic to a packaged product out the door, and you know, sent on its way, like thousands at a time. And I didn't realize it till much later, but I was part of a American manufacturing system that was really dying out, especially when I was doing these things. But over the last several decades, like this American manufacturing has just gone away. And I had the privilege of actually being a part of that American manufacturing system, which was kind of cool. It was stuff that my peers never had experienced. But over the time as my parents, you know, came out with new products, did more manufacturing, I saw the toll that it took, where companies were just more interested in sending stuff overseas than they were of having them done in-house, which was a lot of our business. And we saw a lot of the ups and downs from that. And I mean, these companies are literally sending these products over to save pennies, pennies, and getting back a far less superior product, an inferior product a lot of times from shipping it overseas. And then you have, you know, 90-day shipping turnaround times. And it just like none of it ever really made sense to me. But our entire system is really made and has become more and more a separation. We are separated from those who produce goods. That's not only overseas. There's a lot of, you know, I mean, a lot of our manufacturing has definitely gone overseas, which disconnects us from the people who make the things that we consume. But that's also true of our food system, where, you know, these people are over in places that we don't know about. We don't know the farmers. We don't know the ranchers. We don't know the people, you know, making and packaging our food. They're elsewhere in these giant factories. And so our entire system has separated us, has dehumanized the productive process, the process of production, so that we are further and further removed from any sort of humanity behind the goods we consume, which means that we don't care about where they come from as much. And it also means that those goods are more disposable because of that. And I think that's a really hard system. Like, we're in a really tough position because a lot of those things we can't change, right? We can't change where a bulk of American companies manufacture things. Like, we can, you know, do all the things and, you know, talk to our legislatures and talk about laws and all that stuff. But from a, like, really just human, like, your individual aspect, it's really hard to even think about wrapping your mind around changing any sort of system that we have, any factory farms, you know, those sorts of things. It's really difficult to think of. But I just bring all that up to talk about how much have we given up? How much humanity have we given up in order to just have things cheaper, more things cheaper? Because in a lot of ways, this economy follows the things that we buy. People produce things that are in demand. So the things that we buy and desire are the things that get produced. And if we're willing to buy them cheaper and not care how they get made, then they're going to get made cheaper and not care for the humans that make them, right? One of the most countercultural things I have done maybe in my life to date is recently, I guess almost 6 months ago, I canceled my Prime membership. I know, you're freaking out, right? When I tell people this, they act like I cut off my left arm. Like, they act like it was this was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do, right? Like, people cannot believe that I got rid of my Prime membership. And it's such a simple thing. I don't know that everybody needs to get rid of your Prime membership. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying for me, having a Prime membership meant that I was a sloppy shopper, right? I didn't take time to really think about any of the stuff that I bought, right? I just would go on and I would buy like one small thing at a time. I would have it shipped, which we're not even getting into like a whole, you know, environment sort of conversation here, but I was just a sloppy shopper. I just, we just consumed without even thinking about where we're consuming from. There was no afterthought as to like who actually may have produced these things. Where are these things coming from? And what are these people getting paid? What are these situations that they're like, that they're working in? Like, how do we think about that stuff? And I think for me, just the simple act of getting rid of a Prime membership just made me a tiny bit of a better shopper. Because I have to go and actually find stuff at smaller shops. I have to look around. I have to, you know, make sure I want something in order to really pay shipping for it, or buy enough of something in order to, you know, not pay shipping with free shipping on other goods. And it just changed the way I sort of think about goods. I think about consumables. I think about my life and what my life means, right? And I just think the cost that we have paid in order to be wealthy, right? The things that we have rationalized in order to be a wealthy society and to maintain a quote unquote healthy economy, which who knows what that actually means all of the time, and means something different to a lot of other people. But we have given away a lot of the humanity, a lot of our connection with consumable goods in order to have a lot and a lot of cheap crap, honestly. Right. And I think those are just things. This isn't a call to like change every single thing you do. This is a call to just even think about the way that you consume, the way that you spend. And on top of that, how does your work play into those things, right? How does your company think about consumables and think about people and think about the role of people in these things and think about, you know, where our goods come from if you work for a company that does those sorts of things. And there's no, you know, perfect way to do all this from environmental, all these perspectives. There's no perfect way to do all these things, but have we thought about it? Right? Just like even a first step. You know, one of the more devastating parts of all this and the way that we've set up our system is that there are millions and millions. I'm reading humantraffickinghotline.org right now. It's saying that the estimate is that there's 24.9 million people trapped in forced labor in our world, right? And we just don't think about these things. We don't think about, like, the reason people put other people into slavery, as in, you know, in Revelation here in chapter 18, as in, you know, the when our America was sort of founded on, you know, this slave system, the reason people use slaves is for economic benefit. I don't always think that we put these things together. We're like, yes, slavery is bad because it's, you know, subjecting other people to, you know, not having freedom. But the reason that we do these things is for economic benefit. That's why you have slaves, is to bolster an economy, to make it easier to make lots of money for the one holding the slave. So this slavery and the slavery going on today across our world is brought about because of the way that we consume goods. A lot of times we've sold out humanity in order to have more. And it is patently unbiblical. And what we're seeing here in towards the end of Revelation 17 and 18 is that this is a system that the devil loves. This is a system that the evil one has set up, and that kings, merchants, sea captains, put that into today's context however you want, those categories of people love to commit adultery with this economic system and love to, like, give themselves over to it in order to just have more than everyone else or somebody else, as it were. Got to be thinking about how the way that we operate in this world affects humanity at large. And I know those are really big concepts to think about in your work. That is a huge concept to think about. But what does it mean to make little small changes? What does it mean to just shop a little bit differently? Know a little bit more about where your goods come from. That's not always possible. I've really struggled, to be honest with you, to find goods that you can really trace. But even thinking about these things at work, how do you, what does it look like to push forward, like, more humanity in some small way? Even those small changes like that are kingdom changes. They're opposed to this way that the evil one wants us to operate in this world, y'all. And to be kingdom people means we go out into this world doing kingdom things, and that means caring about humanity. So it doesn't have to be big. You don't have to change your entire life. You don't have to, you know, alter everything. You can if you really feel, you know, the Holy Spirit pushing you in that way right now. But these don't have to be life-altering decisions. It just starts with little decisions. It starts with seeing more. It starts with seeing people more. It starts with thinking more about the things we do, the way we spend our money, the way we use our time. It's little things that bring about great change. And so this is like a really easy place that I can see Revelation being very, very practical. We don't need to get into the weeds of any of this stuff. We can look at these broad themes like the harlot and why all of these merchants, kings, and, you know, sea captains are chasing after this harlot because they want something from her. That's a really easy concept to pull from Revelation and to pull practically in our lives. And not only our lives, but our work, the way we go about, you know, the things that we do every single day, the way we go about consumption, you know, all of these things are just really easy, practical tools. So that's my soapbox on Revelation 17 and 18. I hope you're enjoying the podcast, this little series. I'm really enjoying doing these things. It's a lot of fun to teach through these really practical ways of thinking about a book that, like, is very intimidating a lot of times. So, you know, if you are enjoying this, like, share with your friends. I really appreciate that. That's the way most people find out about Theology of Hustle, is word of mouth. And if you have time, I would really love for you to leave me a rating and review. It's just helpful to other people know that people are listening. That's super helpful to me. And yeah, I'd love any of your feedback. If this brings about thoughts or whatever from, you know, leave me on, hit me up on the social medias, and I'd love to hear what you're thinking and what you're getting out of this series on Revelation and Work. So do all that for me. And until next time, get out there and hustle.